Well, good morning. It's good to see everybody today. Glad we can be together in this Bible class period. You should have received a handout this morning. I will tell you that that will help you as we make our way through the material we're going to look at in the Bible class period. We're going to cover an awful lot in the next 35 minutes or so, and so that will help you as we make our way through this. Wonderful to be with you. We'll have some more introductory kind of things to say at the worship period. We want to get right down to the business at hand this morning. In this Bible class period, the elders have asked me to speak on this subject of keeping sex sacred in our marriage. This is a topic that is conducive for a class of adults like this in this particular series. We'll be talking about a lot of things having to do with family and home over the course of the next 4 days. But we begin with this very important subject for husbands and wives and for those who are not married as yet, as they think about maintaining the purity that God asks us to maintain. I will tell you that I think many people would be surprised to find that the Bible really is anything but prudish when it comes to the issue of dealing with human sexuality. In fact, there's one entire book of the Bible, the Song of Solomon, that is given to extolling the beauty and the sacredness of marital love. And beyond that, there are a host of passages in both the Old and the New Testament alike that address this aspect of the human experience. And we would expect that, would we not? I mean, sexuality is such a powerful part of the human personality and behavior that we really would expect the Bible not only to address that, but to give some beneficial guidelines to govern that for our good. Now, let me begin by saying that I realize that in the discussion, we are navigating some often uncharted territory in churches of Christ. I know that. And yet it's interesting to me that in this series on extreme home makeover, every time that I've been asked to present this series in a congregation somewhere in the country, and I have sent the elders a list of the topics and asked them to choose which of the lessons they want, this lesson has always been chosen without exception. I think it's because there's an understanding that this is an issue with which families and churches must grapple. And yet I understand that though this is an important subject and a biblical subject, I also understand that it is one that we have avoided somewhat like the plague. Now, my father preached for 60 years, and I will guarantee you that he never once, in a Bible class or in a sermon, he never once uttered the word sex. I can guarantee you that. In fact, he's in heaven now, and I'll guarantee you that if he can see me this morning, he's the one going around saying, "Father, forgive him, he doesn't know what he's doing." Because that just was not a part of his generation. And yet, it's an important topic for us to consider. This is an amazing challenge for Christians, both married and single. I read an interview that was done among Christian singles between the ages of 25 and 35, and they were asked, what is the number one temptation that you face? And 90% of them said that it was sexual temptation. One fellow said that the other temptation for the other 10% was obviously lying. Well, that may be true. The fact of the matter is that sexual images in America are absolutely everywhere. In 2011, it is estimated that on broadcast television in America this year, there will be 8,200 acts of sexual intercourse portrayed. 81% of those will be between unmarried couples. And you combine that with shows like Sex and the City that run in syndication on a continual basis, and you look at billboards that are more provocative than ever, and the internet, of course, that allows us to view images in private that we would never dare to view in public. And when you put all of that together and they coalesce, it makes it very much like, as Judge Robert Bork said in the title of his best-selling book, in many ways, morally, we are slouching towards Gomorrah. And my point is simply that there is virtually nowhere that you can hide in American culture from sexual images. Now, just as an aside, let's not lose sight of the fact that the inundation of our culture with sex has not been without consequence. Unwanted pregnancies, sexually transmitted diseases, broken homes, moral disasters, devastating guilt, all are a byproduct of that. But let's also be honest and acknowledge that ours is not the first generation to deal with that, nor will it be the last. So, if you're taking notes on the sheet, let's begin right here. I want to notice, by way of beginning, three simple preliminary principles that I think are foundational to our study. Number one, God created us to bless us, and we ought to understand that. Jesus said, I am come that man might have life and that he might have it more abundantly. And so the guidelines for sexual activity are ultimately for our good. God's will is not to suppress our joy, but to make our lives the most joyful and fulfilling possible. And so God created us to bless us. Secondly, God created us sexual beings. And so we have phrases like Genesis 2, it is not good that a man should be alone. There is something innate in the way God created us. There's something innate within us that craves relationship with the opposite sex, recreationally and intimately and socially, male and female. God created them. Your distinctive sexuality is a part of God's design. The book, The Holy Longing, by Grotto Rollheiser, he talks about that, and he said, if harnessed, that energy moves you to unselfishness and generosity, love and sacrifice. But out of control, it can lead to self-interest and immorality and indulgence and the destruction of others. And that's exactly right. And so God created us to bless us, and he created us sexual beings. But if we don't harness that sexual energy and part of our life, it can be devastating. So thirdly, we should note that God created sexual intimacy for a holy purpose. I know that is true because it bonds two people in the intimate relationship of marriage. There's a passage that we will look at repeatedly over the next 4 days out of Genesis chapter 2. Here's the divine plan. Genesis 2 and 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed. It's interestingly in that, that he says they were one flesh and they were not ashamed. God created Adam and Eve and put them in that sinless environment of Eden and placed them in a situation where they had complete and total transparency in that relationship with each other. They were naked, they were one flesh, they were not ashamed. God allowed them to see and to enjoy the physical differences between them, and he created them in such a way that there was no impediment. They could have unhindered intimacy one with the other. I think that's an important understanding out of Genesis chapter 2. You know, the Allegheny, Monongahela, and Ohio rivers converge in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A mile north of where they converge, you can't take the water and separate it one from another. They are forever blended or fused together. And it seems to me that early on, the Bible teaches us that sex is more than a physical act. It's more than an act that fuses two bodies together. That it was designed by God to be a genuine union of two individuals in body and mind and soul. That was so important to God that in his wisdom, he provided for that relationship to be within the confines of the marriage relationship. And so Hebrews 13 and verse 4, that marriage is to be held in honor by all, and the bed undefiled, because adulterers and fornicators God will judge. And so God put that within the parameters in a protected relationship of marriage. Otherwise, dangerous, dangerous things happen. You know, driving a car, when you first do that, is a very pleasurable and exciting kind of experience. But given that it's a very dangerous experience, our government and its wisdom put some boundaries around that, some parameters around that. You don't give those privileges to just anyone. And so not everybody's permitted to drive. You have to be of a certain age. You have to be physically and mentally competent. You have to pass a test. You have to do some things in order to be safe in that activity. A 10-year-old child can theoretically get behind the wheel of a car. Maybe you saw on the news last year where a child did that. About 10 years old, had watched his mom drive the car. So he got in and he figured out how to put the key in the ignition, and he figured out how to start the thing and put it in drive. And it was a disaster waiting to happen. Now, he had a lot of fun for a little while, and it was probably pretty exciting, but it was a disaster waiting to happen. And so, too, sex is such a powerful emotional energy that God has restricted its expression to within the boundaries of marriage. I think that's why God's teaching is so very clear. And so God says things like this: the body is not designed by God for sexual immorality. Flee sexual immorality. This is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. You ever hear somebody say, I just wish I knew what God's will was for my life? Well, I'll tell you, here's a part of it. Here's something you can know for certain, that it is God's will for us that we be sanctified, that we be holy. And a part of that is that we abstain from sexual immorality. It's not because God is some kind of a cosmic killjoy who's determined to destroy our fun, but because He knows what is best for us. So, with those preliminary principles out of the way, let's talk for a couple of minutes now about four very dangerous deceptions. Four things that we are told in American culture that we need to understand will never be in vogue with God. Four things that we need to think about. Common perception number one in America. What I think can't hurt me. What I think can't hurt me. That is, sexual thought is harmless. As long as it's only in my mind, as long as I'm not acting on it, it's really no harm at all. And so, I can have sexual thoughts, I can watch suggestive or explicit material, I can read whatever I want, and as long as it's only in my mind, then it's of no harm. Now, we know better than that, don't we? We know that the Bible teaches that our mind matters. And we're familiar with statements like Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Or Proverbs 23:7, as a man or a woman thinks in his heart, so in fact they are. What's the point of that, ladies and gentlemen? The point is that oftentimes Christians end up behaving in ways they should not behave because they begin thinking things they should not think. In American psychology, for the past 30 years, a focus has been on two basic laws. The law of cognition, that says you are what you think, and the law of behavior, that says your mind absorbs and then will reflect whatever is exposed to. When you put the two together, you are what you think, and you think about what you are exposed to. No wonder the Bible is so careful to say that Christians have to build some boundaries around their thought life. And so let me ask you this morning, what's your standard of mental purity? Where have you drawn the line for yourself? What will you allow your eyes to see, your ears to hear, and your mind to dwell on? J. Wallace Hamilton, in his book, Horns and Halos in the Human Heart, said these words. He said, two natures beat within my breast. The one is foul, the other blessed. The one I love, the one I hate. But the one I feed will dominate. And he was right about that. What we feed our mind will be exactly what we will become. Secondly, sexual fantasy, we are told in American culture, is normal and healthy. Sexual fantasy is normal and it is healthy. Well, do you suppose when you read your Bible that that was the case with Ammon and Tamar? I doubt it very seriously. People who get caught up in sexual fantasy almost always end up going where they never planned to go, doing things they never dreamed or imagined that they would do. And so the fact of the matter is that our heart matters. And it matters greatly. What we feed our minds and what we allow to take root and germinate and grow in our hearts matters greatly. I want you to look at the screen with me for just a second. Salah or Job said, lust is a shameful sin. It is a devastating fire that destroys to hell. It could wipe out everything that you own. How many people have learned that the hard way? How many men and women have had their families completely wiped out because of lust, this shameful act that became in their life a devastating, indiscriminate fire that just burned and destroyed everything in its wake, often laying destruction to a marriage, to a mate, to children who are caught in the wake of that fire. That's why in verse 1 of that passage, Job said, I have made a covenant with my eyes never to look lustfully at a woman again. Well, why? Well, because sexual sin will always take you further than you want to go. One author said, and I like this a great deal, one author said, if you think you can play with this fire and not be burned, then you are godlier than David, you are wiser than Solomon, and you are stronger than Samson. Think about those three Bible characters, David and Solomon and Samson. I mean, these are amazing individuals in the Bible, men of immense strength, men who walked with God in many ways, were blessed by God in many ways, and yet they were men who, because they could not control this aspect of their lives, ended up in horrible circumstances. The challenge, ladies and gentlemen, is that we tend to overestimate our strength. We tend to believe that we are stronger than we often really are, that we can expose ourselves to things that we believe will not harm us, but eventually, if they take root in our mind and germinate and grow and develop, will always bring us difficulty. There's a reason why Paul said to his young protege, Timothy, you need to flee sexual immorality. The word comes from the Latin fugitivus, in which we get our word fugitive, and Paul is saying to Timothy, I want you to be a fugitive from sexual immorality. Remember the movie, The Fugitive, with Harrison Ford? What did he do? He was on the run. That's exactly what that means. I read a story once about a safari guide in Africa who was leading a group on safari. And somebody asked him one day, they said to the old guy, they said, is it true that wild animals will not attack you if you're carrying a torch? The old guy looked at him and said, well, it depends on how fast you're carrying it. There's a lot of truth in there. You've got to stay a step ahead. Flee sexual immorality. The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, that God doesn't want us to end up like those who, when Peter spoke, they had eyes full of adultery and they cannot cease from sin. What a terrible state that is. That is, these individuals have reached the point where they view every person through the lens, through the filter, through the eyes of adultery. That's what sexual sin will do. It will take control of your life. Thirdly, we're told in American culture, I must act on my desires. It was the playwright Oscar Wilde who once said that the only way to successfully deal with temptation is to give in to it. He was wrong about that. Because from God's vantage point, your life matters. And the fact of the matter is that what we have fed our mind will eventually be lived out. Every sin, it doesn't matter what it is, first gains approval in our mind before it is given action in our flesh. The idea that I must act on my desires is wrong. The Bible teaches that your life matters. And so we have examples of individuals like Genesis 39 and Joseph. And Joseph, who is being seduced by Potiphar's wife, and you have to know that this was an ongoing situation. You have to know that he had thought about this and how he's going to respond to this. And so on this occasion, where she is very bold about what she wants, his response is, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? She will argue against that a little bit. And yet in Genesis 39 and 8, about her advances, the Bible simply says, he refused. In American culture, the tendency would be to look at Joseph in that setting and say, let me tell you, Joseph must not have been much of a man. But I would say to you, ladies and gentlemen, it took a great deal more courage on his part to flee than it would have taken to fornicate. But let me ask you something this morning. What happens if we don't say no? What happens when we believe that idea that I have to act on my desires? I'm in a circumstance where I not only have the desire, but I have the ability to act upon this. What happens if I do act on those desires outside of marriage? Well, let me say two things. I want you to listen very carefully. Number one, I would suggest that we assume ownership of something that doesn't really belong to us. That is, when we say yes, when we should say no, we've assumed ownership of something that does not ultimately belong to us. The fact of the matter is that our bodies, first of all, belong to God. So Paul said, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have of God? You are not your own, he said. You understand that. That's his question. Do you understand that you are not your own? You have been purchased at a price. And so glorify God in your body and spirit, which are God's. And so first of all, Paul says, look, your body first of all belongs to God, not you. You're just a steward of that. And secondly, your body belongs to your mate. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And so the point of it is that your body belongs first of all to God and secondly to your mate. Now, by the way, just as an aside, may I say here, And the Bible talks about two types of sexual sin. We typically, in our fellowship in churches of Christ, have only talked about one. The one we talk about is giving your body to somebody to whom it does not belong. And so stepping outside of that boundary of marriage is what we typically talk about. And that's certainly right. That's sinful. But the Bible also talks about the sin of withholding your body from the one to whom it does belong. Withholding your body from the right person. And that is equally wrong. And I would say, especially to women in this audience, that if you are married and you use sexual relations as a bargaining chip with your husband, or if you are withholding sexual relationship from your husband as punishment to him, not only is that wrong, but it's very dangerous and damaging. We assume ownership of something that doesn't belong to us. I think that sometimes, especially in talking to our young people, we've not emphasized that as we should. Sometimes, especially in talking to our young people, we emphasize what I think are the, I hesitate to use the word wrong motives for morality, but not the biblical motive. I remember when I was a teenager, you know, there were those times that the young teenage boys would be separated in our Bible classes from the young teenage girls, and somebody would talk to us about these kind of matters. And they would say, you know what, you need to be morally pure. You need to not engage in sexual activity before you were married. And they would say, you need to do that because there might be an unwanted pregnancy. And how terrible would that be? And you might contract a disease, a sexually transmitted disease, and that would be a horrible thing. If that were to become known, think about how that would embarrass your mom and dad. Well, all of those were true. I'm not denying that. Those would all be unwanted and terrible things. That's very true. But the biblical motivation for morality is that your body belongs first and foremost to God. And He therefore has the right to tell us how we behave with what belongs to Him. And then secondly, when we say yes, we should say no. We give occasion to the enemies of God to blaspheme. You'll recognize that those were the words of the prophet Nathan to David after his sin with Bathsheba. And that old prophet, I think, with ice in his veins and steel in his soul to confront the monarch the way he did and say, you are the man. You have given occasion to the enemies of God to blaspheme. We need to understand that, ladies and gentlemen. Every time a Christian lies, every time a Christian cheats, every time a Christian steals, every time a Christian fornicates or commits adultery, he says to the world, I belong to God, and this is the way that one who belongs to God behaves. We give occasion to the enemies of God to blaspheme. Dangerous deception number three, I must act on my desires. No, you must not. And then finally, dangerous deception number four. Again, this never happened to me. Now, maybe you're here this morning. And everybody here is listening very well, and I appreciate that. And so maybe you're here this morning, you've listened kind of politely to all of this, but in your mind you're also listening, maybe with a little bit of disdain, and thinking, you know, Don, there are probably some other people who need to hear this, but not me. This is never going to be an issue with me. Absolutely, positively, could never happen to me. And I just say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that your will matters. And your will about this is a matter that needs guarding and bolstering forever. I think about Proverbs 18, the beginning of verse 12. Before his downfall, a man's heart is proud, but humility comes before honor. Before a downfall, a man's heart is proud. Let me say this as clearly as I know how. The first step to avoiding a collision with immorality is to realize that you are, in fact, capable of becoming involved. Nobody. No married person who ever gets involved in infidelity ever believes that that could have happened to him or to her. I believe the Bible when it says that we have an active adversary who is in fact seeking our destruction. That we must put on the whole armor of God, that we may stand against the wiles of the devil. A word that has to do with scheming and methodology. It's almost as if Paul is saying, listen, I know it's hard to believe, but I want you to understand that Satan has a personalized blueprint for the destruction of your life. And if that can involve the destruction of your family and the corruption of your purity, then so much the better for him. So, with that understanding, I want to talk a little bit for the minutes that we have left to those of us who are married. And I want to talk to us a little bit about protecting our marriages. Now, I want to ask you, if you're married and you're in this audience this morning, you're about to be married, I want you to listen very, very carefully what I'm about to say. We all want to protect our marriage. We've heard this verse how many times in our lives? Marriage should be honored by all, and husbands and wives must be faithful to one another. God will judge those who are immoral and those who commit adultery. We understand that. The message of that passage is too clear, too obvious to misunderstand. So, understanding that, let me ask you this morning, what on earth is it that causes husbands and wives who have vowed and pledged, promised before God and man, that they will be true only to the other until the day that one of them buries the other, what is it that causes individuals sometimes to stray from that in their marriages? Solomon described an affair, adultery, in graphic language. He used the words pit and snare and trap. And so I just want to ask you this morning, what is it? How does a married person who has vowed fidelity to their mate, how do they fall into that pit or that snare or that trap? Well, I think one way is sometimes by unmet needs. The fact of the matter is that when any basic need in your mate's life is not being met, that you are then opening the door to temptation. Now, for men, that unmet need is often a sexual need. For women, that unmet need is often an emotional or relational need. I'll tell you very candidly that most affairs for women start with emotional attachment, not physical attachment. But for both men and women, that's a challenge. For men who often feel an unmet sexual need and women who often feel an unmet emotional need. May I just say to both men and women, it's why the internet is such a challenging thing for both men and women. Women oftentimes find the emotional or relational attachment in the anonymity of a keyboard in somebody that they communicate with that way. And it's not because they want to have an intimate sexual relationship, but because they want to have the emotional and relational attachment that talking with somebody who will listen and spend the time to think about what they are saying and respond to them and begin that dialogue, almost always it's that begins before the sexual relationship. For men, the internet is such a terrible challenge because men have such a strong sense of visual stimuli. I will tell you that internet pornography, if we think that that has not touched the ranks of Christians among us, we are sadly and sorely mistaken. And so men who are feeling somewhat of an unmet need sexually with a couple of clicks of the mouse can immediately be inundated with images that were a decade or two decades ago unavailable. It's a terrible challenge for men. And I would say to the men in this audience that if you are facing any kind of a challenge with that, with abuse of pornography on the internet, you need to think carefully about it. I would recommend to you the book by Joshua Harris entitled Not Even a Hint, Guarding Your Heart Against Lust. It's a wonderful book that talks about those matters. If you know someone that has a problem with internet pornography, a man who is struggling with internet pornography, I would recommend to you the book by Ted Roberts entitled Pure Desire, or Henry Rogers, The Silent War. They're wonderful resources. I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that I've been called into homes to try to deal with that issue. I've had to find counselors for men in places to deal with that issue, and it is absolutely devastating to a family, horribly addicting to individuals who are involved. Unmet needs. And secondly, unfulfilled expectations. You know, sometimes things turn out differently in a marriage than you expected, and it's easy to begin to feel bitter and cheated. And I will guarantee you this, if you feel cheated in your marriage, our adversary, the devil, will make sure that you come in contact with somebody of the opposite sex who also feels cheated in life. Satan will always bring into your path someone who understands you, is willing to listen to you. And unresolved conflicts. Conflicts in relationship will cause one of two responses. Either first, you will work it out and be drawn closer together, or you will begin to withdraw and avoid physical and emotional contact. It is the latter of those two that leads a marriage partner to often end up saying, "Look, I found someone at work who understands me. I found someone at work who is so easy to talk to. When something's not right at home and you're not satisfied with your role in your relationship, you need to be aware. You either deal with that immediately or deeper problems inevitably will come." And third, unreliable commitment. And what I mean by that is simply not remembering the vows you made and honoring those vows. Lord willing, we'll talk Wednesday night about remembering and honoring our vows. And we'll talk a little bit about what we promised each other when we got married and make some applications about that. But we stood before God and man when we married and we said, "I promise, I am promising God and I'm promising you and all of these individuals are witnesses that I will forsake all others from this day until the day that one of us buries the other, I will be sexually faithful to you only." I want to tell you, we have to renew that vow every day. We must never be like Augustine, who once said, "Lord, deliver me from lust, but not yet." That's not an option in marriage. To build an affair-proof marriage, we must consider our attitude toward adultery. And we must ask ourselves, is it on my list of options in any way? Can I think of any experience, any circumstance, any setting whatsoever where I would say yes to another person? God's standard was this. Solomon's song, "Close your heart to every love but mine. Hold no one in your arms but me." And then in the minutes we have left, I want to talk for just a second about an unprotected lifestyle. And that is living a life where you have developed or you have the opportunity to develop an improper relationship with the opposite sex. It's so easy to be in relationships where it's easy for a line to be crossed. Sometimes that's couples who know each other so well and they're so familiar with each other that barriers begin to be broken down. Or maybe it's co-workers or relatives of your spouse. And I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen, we need to be careful and make sure that we recognize the pattern that can come into play. I put these on your handout. These come from Dr. J. Lindsay, a psychologist in Boulder, Colorado, who wrote that seldom is an affair a spontaneous action, but almost always the culmination of several steps on a downward spiral. And I think that's exactly right. The steps that lead a mate ultimately to affair usually follow some progression. And it may not be exactly this, but I will guarantee you most of these would be somewhere in the place. Readiness. That is, things are not going well at home. My spouse is not meeting my needs. And so secondly, I have an increased awareness and attraction to the opposite sex. And I rationalize that by saying, you know what, it's okay to flirt a little bit. It's all right to fantasize a little bit. I'm only human and I'm not hurt anybody in that. And so that would lead thirdly to innocent meeting. That is, contact that is by common activity. Maybe it's because you work in the same place or because you're friends as a couple or maybe because you go to church together. And fourth, intentional meeting. and a meeting that occurs on purpose because you have monitored the path of the other person. You've thought about this. You know where he or she is going to be, and you want to interact with them, and so you make it a point to be there to interact with them. And again, you rationalize, saying, you know what, it's all right to play these games. Nobody's getting hurt. No harm is being done. And I've earned a little bit of fun in my life. And then public lingering, that is, talking to this individual through the exclusion of others. Even though you're in a public setting, you exclude others from conversation and focus mostly, or if not entirely, on them. And it leads almost always to private lingering. That is, you begin in a group context, but it continues with this person after virtually everybody else is gone. And again, you rationalize that by saying, look, it's all right. They chose to leave. It's not my fault if they wanted to leave and leave us here alone. And it leads almost always to purposeful isolation. That is a pre-planned time alone for what you say are legitimate purposes. That is, I've got to drop this by their home. I've got to drop this report by their house for work. Or we've got to work together on that project. And then affectionate physical contact. Now, I emphasize the word affectionate physical contact. I'm not talking about the hug of friends when they greet each other at church, or couples that are close to each other and they go out for an evening together and they hug each other when they see each other when they're leaving at the end of the year. Ladies and gentlemen, I live in the deep south. I live in Florida. I live in the deep south. We hug the stuffing out of everybody down there. But that's not what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. It's the kind of hug that lingers and stirs thoughts and feelings that are not appropriate. And it leads finally to capitulation. That which we thought would never happen, happens. And immediately we say, it'll never happen again. I shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. I'm sorry. It will never happen again. But in most cases, it does. And then we rationalize and say, well, my wife, my husband, they just don't meet my needs. And if we don't stop there, and if that point doesn't lead us to repentance, it will almost always lead to acceptance of the wrong behavior. Or we admit that we are having an affair out of choice, but still we rationalize. We love each other so much. The chemistry between us is so strong. We were just right for each other. And then finally, the words that I have heard countless times from individuals involved in an affair, when they finally say, you know what? I was never really happy in my marriage. Ladies and gentlemen, if you find yourself somewhere in those steps, I encourage you, as a child of God, and out of respect for your mate and your children, and out of the security of your soul, to bail out of that now. Before we go this morning, I want to...
Take another 5 minutes.
Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about something said in this book, Not Just Friends. Protect your relationship from infidelity and heal the trauma of betrayal. This is a book by Dr. Shirley Glass. And while I wouldn't recommend everything in the book, there's a wonderful chapter for husbands and wives. 9 suggestions for keeping temptation at arm's length for infidelity. I just think they're outstanding, ladies and gentlemen. Number one, she says, monitor your marriage. Because the fact of the matter is that every one of us know how things are going in our marriage. We know when things are going well. We know when things are not going well. We know when our intimate relationship with our mate is what it ought to be and when it is not. We need to be honest about that. Secondly, stay alert for temptation. We know when we are being inappropriately drawn to somebody of the opposite sex. We are not simpletons about these things. And thirdly, don't flirt. If you are married, you have no right to flirt with anybody the opposite sex at any time. Fourth, recognize that work can be a danger zone. And one of the reasons why it's a danger zone, ladies and gentlemen, is that the work setting is an artificial setting. What do we do before we get up and go to work? We get up, we kind of fix ourselves up. We get dressed, we look nice when we go to work. We go to a setting where there are no, you know, there's no pressure about bills and kids or diapers or soccer or what we're going to do with that or dealing with an aged, an infirm parent. We go to work and we've got to deal with the reality of life. We're in that work kind of bubble that is artificial. It is such a dangerous, dangerous place if we allow ourselves to spend inordinate time with somebody the opposite sex. Beware the lure of the internet. It is such a terrible challenge for men and women. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just say to you that if you do not have a filter on your computer for the internet, you are asking for trouble. I would encourage you to jot down two websites, besecure.com, BESECURE.com, and the other one is hedgebuilders.com. Now, there are countless websites that do filtering, but these two are wonderful. And I'll tell you something, if you want to be truly transparent with your mate, let your mate set your password. Just give your mate that peace of mind that you're not going to be going to a place you shouldn't go. And ladies and gentlemen, especially, let me say to you, if you have children in your home and you don't have a filter on your computer, it is roughly analogous to releasing a poisonous snake in your house and just hoping that it will never bite anyone. Yes, we must be careful about that. Keep old flames from reigniting. I just say about that, be careful with your Facebook account. How many marriages have gotten in trouble because somebody reunited with an old flame that was out of sight and out of mind? Value intimacy in your marriage. We have to work on that. We have to work to keep the romance alive and the intimate relationship alive. Make sure your social network supports marriage. That is, if you're having difficulty in your marriage and you know you are, don't be spending your time with people who don't value marriage. You need to spend your time with people who are going to encourage you to do the right thing. And then finally, stay honest with your partner. And I want to say especially to the men in this audience, you need to be transparent with your mate. That means the world to a wife. I try to do that as best I can. If during the course of a day when I'm at work and one of the ladies from our congregation emails me, and it may be about something important, it may be about something not important at all, they just wanted to talk with me about. If I email back and forth with her, at the end of the day, I will always tell Vicki, I will say, hey, I emailed back and forth with so-and-so today. I do the same about texting. If I text back and forth one lady of our church, I will always tell Vicki about that at the end of the day. For about a decade, my wife was a school nurse. She was a good school nurse, and she spent a lot of hours doing her job. And so, occasionally, there was a lady in our church who cleaned houses. That's the way she made a lot of money. And so, occasionally, I'd have her come and clean our house just as a way to kind of help Vicki a little bit. And I always knew what day she was going to come when we did that, but I didn't know when she was going to be there. And so sometimes I'd go home for lunch and she would be there. So what I would do every time, I would go in, I would holler at her, say, hey, I'm here, I'm grabbing my lunch and leaving. And that's what I would do. I wouldn't stay there and eat. I'd get my lunch and I'd leave. But when I left, I would always call Vicki and say, hey, just went by the house. Once you know, Gene was there cleaning day. I grabbed my lunch and I'm headed back to the office now. She's never asked me to do that. Vicki's never once asked me to do any of that. She never would. But I do that because I want to be transparent with her. She's always known that whether I'm in Temple Terrace, Florida, or Los Angeles, California, or wherever it may be, she's always known. I don't have to worry about what Don is doing. There's a transparency there. And I would just say to the men in this church, you need to have that with your mate. It will mean an awful lot to her. I recommend to every married couple the book by Jerry Jenkins entitled Hedges. The subtitle is Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It. It's a wonderful book. And we all need that in our marriage. Well, I'm way past time, but I want to say one final thing real quickly. We began with three preliminary principles. God created us to bless us, created us sexual beings, and created sexual intimacy for a holy purpose. There is a fourth, and that is that God loves and is willing to forgive His creation. We need to understand that. That God is willing to forgive us when we fail. There may be terrible consequences that have to be borne. There were for David. Things were never the same after his sin with Bathsheba. The child died. War did not leave his house. But God forgave him and forgave him completely. There was a woman taken in adultery in John 8. And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you." But it doesn't mean that He gave her a free pass. He said, "Go your way." Remember what He said? Sin no more. The wrong is wrong. You can be forgiven, not condemned eternally. But make sure now that you put the boundaries in place so that you don't behave that way anymore. Thank you for listening so well this morning.